Today's program was brought to you by Blueprint, the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. For more information, visit blueprint.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
Hello. First, we're going to go to the Green Market. Every week, we go see what's good and gorgeous and delicious.
I'm here with Peter Weltman, sommelier at the Nomad. He was responsible for the 58 farmer and small producer profiles in Will Gadara and Daniel Hum's I Heart New York cookbook. Hey, Peter.
Hello.
Okay, so honey.
Yeah, honey. It was actually the one thing in the book. So we went to Tremblay Apiaries up in the Finger Lakes area of New York State, and I didn't know anything about it. I was super impressed with what I learned doing it. And Al Tremblay, which is his kind of namesake apiary, was one of the more interesting guys we met. Was really into like U.S. history, had traveled the world with his bees, and really just taught me a lot. So I always, at the beginning of each season, I buy with the honey elixir, which has propolis and bee pollen in it, and I take it and it helps to kind of cure allergies. I don't know, and I really like it.
It actually works?
Yeah, every season I do it.
And so how do you take it? So
I just take it straight.
Okay, wait, so the pollen, it's powdery.
Yeah, so they blend it into a creamed honey.
Oh.
Yeah, it's
so it's extra like the fountain of youth, like extra potent, like good stuff.
Well, propolis is what they feed the queen bee. That's what separates the queen from the workers. She gets propolis, so she actually gets like nutrient rich food, so she can kind of develop her mind and like her productive whatever.
And be amazing.
Yeah, she can be amazing because she eats propolis. So therefore, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid.
You just want to be queen bee.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Leti Su on heritageradionetwork.org. I can't believe that we've passed the midpoint of the months. So this month feels extremely compressed for me because I'm heading to Chicago at the end of the month, and we're going to talk more about that because we actually have some guests in the studio where we're going to talk about what we're going to be talking about and eating, specifically American food. Fancy that. Want to tell you about a fried chicken karaoke late night party for our restaurant friends, sommeliers, bartenders, chefs, cooks, servers. Come out on the 23rd to Terroir Murray Hill, where we're doing a daytime tasting and a nighttime bash for David Rosengarten. We're getting friends together to launch his wine portfolio. You can actually tweet at me for the information because I'm not going to read the invite URL out loud right now. And, you know, it's almost end of the month, which means that we're close to what to me is kind of like finding a dollar bill or $20 bill, actually, or a cookie in my pocket or something, because I absolutely love Andrew Steinthal's Infatuation playlist. And I actually kind of discovered it. It's on Spotify, by the way. I kind of discovered it organically. I didn't know that this guy and his partner, Chris Ding, write a food blog, Immaculate Infatuation. I just kind of, you know, Spotify is this, an awesome product. I like good products. That's kind of what I believe in, products that work. I came across this playlist, and now it's like the source of fun new music. You know, I'm not a music expert. You can't be an expert in everything. And every month, When I open up my Spotify and I see this playlist, I'm so happy. And I didn't know that these guys were food people too. So I just want to shout out to my food and music people. Thanks for the yumminess and the nice soundingness all the time, every month. Check it out, Infatuation playlist. So we're going to cut to a quick break, commercial break, and then welcome our guests. Stay tuned.
Took without asking, took without asking. Today's break song is called Waterfall by Jen Jaden and the Greenstone, and this is Word of Mouth on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
On deceiving, kept me believing, blaming me for fool. You're saying that you want me, saying that you love me. I never thought you'd be so cruel. You forgot to say, baby, it's all over. I am letting you know, baby, it's all over. I'm letting this go.
Blueprint is the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. Designed to purify and detoxify, Blueprint Cleanse is made from the freshest 100% raw and USDA-certified organic ingredients, cold-pressed to retain nutrients and flavor. Blueprint also offers a line of organic juices, cold-pressed and raw, in a variety of fruit and vegetable combinations, and available in individual bottles. Blueprint Cleanse is available at Whole Foods Market and many other retailers across the U.S. To learn more about their line of organic cleanses, juices, and other products, visit them today at blueprint.com or call them at 866-774-6831. That's 866-774-6831. Work hard, play hard. Cleanse, repeat.
We have some people we like here in the studio, live at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on Word of Mouth with Leyte Sue on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome, Alex Stupak, Chef Empeon Cocina.
Hey, how are you?
And Empeon Taqueria, and maybe soon another Empeon. I don't know.
Maybe one of these days.
Maybe one of these restaurants are running me ragged.
So.
And also our friend Stephen Torres, founder of Imbibe and Inspire, a source of what's inspiring videos and other great content, what's inspiring chefs and chefs inspiring chefs and all this really good stuff. And, you know, the reason why I wanted to catch them in the studio for a little chat now is because we're all headed to Chicago at the end of this month for a chefy get-together. Some food writers and other food sort of amazing people. The event is called The Roots of American Foodways. Now, I have to say, like, you know, we walk around saying foodways. Let's just define that. It's just, you know, let's define foodways. I'm making fun of this word.
Well, the foodways, I mean, the definition in the dictionary technically is, you know, the way a culture eats, like how they get their food, mm-hmm. and all those kind of sort of things interrelated to that. So for this first event, I wanted to kind of build, I want this to be an inaugural event. I want this to be the kind of foundation. And I thought, what better, you know, foundation, I think synonymous with roots and doing something that, you know, just kind of talks about how it all started.
And I'm just, you know, I'm loving that it's focused on American food because we forget to talk about American food. We're just sort of like super weirdly lucky that here in, I mean, particularly New York, but all across America, we can have whatever we want at any time we want it. You know, it's at high and low price points. Like, we're pretty darn lucky. So Alex, you Mexican food is your mission. I'm curious to know, you know, why Mexican food? Like, What gets you excited?
I can give you a lot of reasons. Well, like,
I want all of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the first reason would be that it's delicious, but that's not good enough because there's a lot of delicious cuisines out there. Then the next reason would have to be that I really love that it's an underdog as far as cuisines go. Like, people forget that Italian cuisine and French cuisine are ethnic cuisines. We think of ethnic cuisine as Thai or Vietnamese or Mexican or what have you. And I really love that when I started learning about it, yes, like I said, it's delicious, but also you start to find all this beautiful sort of counterintuitive logic in it. You think you know better, you know, you go to a you go to a culinary school, you have French training, and then you see all these techniques that are kind of wacky and they almost seem like they're wrong. And then you kind of learn that it's just the gods sort of handed that part of the world a different set of ingredients, and the cooks had to respond and think and evolve in a different way. So there's all that I'm in love with. I also love that, again, there seems to be this unwritten thing about Mexican cuisine, not just Mexican, a lot of ethnic cuisines, that they should be at a certain price point, and you have to use a certain level of ingredients, which unfortunately might be lesser than some other cuisines get to use. And beyond getting to cook something that's delicious all day, I really love sort of fighting that fight and changing perception.
Why did you pick Mexican food and not, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, Andy Ricker does Thai food. What about my Taiwanese food? Or, you know, what, there's got to be
it's
maybe
a good question.
Personal.
Yeah, it would have been a lot more of a romantic story if I had, if my parents had a house in Oaxaca and they had been taking me since I was four. That would have made more sense. It's really simple. My wife, Lauren, she's born in California, but she's of Mexican descent. We were planning our wedding in Los Angeles, and her mother took me out to this little place in East LA, and that was the first time I ever had a fresh tortilla. And when I say fresh, I mean it was pressed out, laid on a comal, and then served to you right then and there. And for me, that was just as epiphanal as the first time I had ever gotten to, you know, hold a white truffle, or the first time I ever got to make, you know, a foam following a recipe in an El Bulli book. And for me, it just felt very much new. So when I was cooking at Alinea and WD-50, I ended up working for those guys, for Grant and Wiley, because I thought they were pioneers and they were pushing in a new direction. When I got to the age around 28 or 29, my biological clock started ticking, and I said I had to have my own restaurant. Creativity is still the most important thing for me, but I define creativity as trying to figure out what you don't know how to do. So that plus, you know, studying more and more about Mexican cuisine, and the fact that I knew it was going to also be something provocative, and I knew that it was something that I would have to work on for quite some time to get it where I want it to be, I thought those were all good enough reasons to open a restaurant.
You know, that's nice that you said creativity is doing what you don't know. It's like there's a certain bravery to that. And I just remember a conversation recently with one actually very talented and high-profile chef who is doing great things, and he specifically said, well, I love Chinese food so much, but I'm never going to go open a Chinese restaurant because that's just not what I was trained to do. And there's some chefs that like stay in that lane of training, and then there's some chefs that are like, well, I have a full arsenal of like different weapons, different arrows
and,
to attack it.
And by forcing yourself to prepare another cuisine, you find yourself using ingredients and techniques that you otherwise normally wouldn't. So it actually forces change in a healthy way.
I mean, I think Alex is definitely abnormal in that sense. I mean, he, you know, when like every person who's in this conference, you know, I mean, they've done interviews on the website, but they also, you know, like they affected me in a certain way, you know, like everyone that I asked to be a part of it, it wasn't just to be a part of it. Like you can ask Alex, like I probably asked him like maybe 5 or 6 times.
Yeah, I kept saying no.
before he said yes. I mean, I asked him here in New York. I think, I don't know if we were in Chicago, we were in Aspen.
You're definitely persistent.
And, but the thing about Alex is that, you know, I know where he comes from as far as like, you know, Cleo with Ken Oranger and Alinea with Grant. And then he just like totally just like flipped the script, you know, and just went on and did his own thing. And like when I interviewed Nick and Grant, you know, Nick said was, you know, I tried
Nick,
to
Nick Kokonis.
Nick Kokonis, yeah, sorry. He's the owner of Alinea. He's like, I tried to talk Alex out of this. Like, I thought that it was such a mistake.
What was that conversation like? I mean, he only briefly mentioned it, and then I just love it. I love that you're like, meh.
Well, it was I felt a little bit dejected. I mean, at the end of the day, I was trying to scrap together a business plan, and as most chefs, we're no good with spreadsheets or financials or any of that stuff. I had it in my head that to open a restaurant, I said, well, I probably have the cooking and kitchen stuff down. that stuff will come. But I said, what I probably don't have is the financial and operational models and all this stuff. And I became obsessed with trying to present that to people. What I kind of learned was that you're better off if you're pitching something to someone, you're better off just displaying your passion. So in a lot of ways, like when I approached Nick, I was very intent on showing him a hole in the marketplace. And it was actually, even though he kind of shot it down, it was a good dejection. It was a positive dejection because it made me realize that finding a hole in a marketplace is not a reason for opening a restaurant. I mean, it can be one, but it's not a good one in my mind. It has to be based on passion, and it has to be based on something that you just believe no matter what has to exist, even if it's for an illogical reason.
That's amazing. I mean, I remember when your first restaurant first opened and thinking about Mexican food made with great ingredients and at a higher price point. And I'm from California, but I don't have that Mexican militant Mexican food thing going on.
And just to be clear, when we say higher price point, I mean, once you start getting into the world of Mexican cuisine, people go, whoa, $2.50 for a taco? Whoa, slow down. And so it's really like, at the end of the day, my two restaurants are actually, I think, relatively inexpensive compared to many in New York City. But it's more a matter of, so you're going to have a serious kitchen and you're going to have serious cooks, but somehow you have to look them in the eye and tell them that they can't use anything other than frozen shrimp and pork shoulder because that's what the price point will afford them. I think that's wrong.
Absolutely. And tacos as a vessel for yumminess inside. I mean, every kid in the world gets to have like some stuff inside of a vessel, and it's like a dumpling or a gnocchi or like a ravioli or an empanada, and that makes me happy that kids all over the world get to have that. And so as a grown-up kid, you know, I'm looking at scallops inside of a taco and I'm just like, I want that. Like,
right.
I want that.
Like, I mean, I equate it a lot to eating sushi in that, like, well, I'll argue that the tortilla is the most important thing, and perhaps rice is the most important thing in sushi, but it's also a vehicle for enjoying different products.
Absolutely.
And I think right now, looking at tacos, we're actually quite limited, in this country anyways, in terms of what products we think you can enjoy on a tortilla. So if you can enjoy some really great pork or some really great chicken, why can't you enjoy a gorgeous slice of raw fish or a seared scallop or you know, a piece of caramelized apple or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have this, you know, you're a pastry chef originally, and then and a lot of world-class molecular gastronomy training. And so you have a lot to work with, and then mm-hmm. have classical French, of course, and, you know, and now what I always think about when I have ethnic food that's like elevated or something a little different, I always wonder if it's, you know, for you, if it's the ingredients that make it, or if it's that one moment of inspiration, or if it's like picking Mexican techniques or French techniques where they fit, or molecular gastronomy techniques where they fit. Like, what is Mexican about it? And are there Mexican techniques that are completely, you know, opposite of what the French training tells you to do?
Right. They're all very important things to consider that you bring up. I think the most important thing is that we've tried to say, well, what defines the cuisine? Is it its ingredients or its techniques? And it's honestly a little bit of both and different combinations from time to time. So sometimes like the other day we just made, we said, well, we're going to make XO sauce, but we're going to replace the fermented black bean with just Mexican black beans. And we're going to replace the ham that's normally in it with toluca and chorizo. And we're going to replace the dried scallops with dried shrimp because they use a lot of dried shrimp in Mexican cuisine. And so we made it. And was it Mexican? Absolutely not. It was delicious as hell. and we were happy to serve it. But when we tasted it, just the proportions, even though we were only using Mexican ingredients, it didn't yield something Mexican, so it can't just be the ingredients. Now, on the inverse, we made a Scotch egg the other day, and it was just a soft-boiled egg, and we coated that in chorizo, and instead of doing it in breadcrumbs, we made a masa tempura. Now, again, you're borrowing techniques from another culture, and you're only using Mexican ingredients, but was it Mexican? And in that instance, it just tasted like chorizo and egg, so we would say yes.
Then in that instance, the Scotch egg, the first mention of the Scotch egg sauce, the Scotch egg really stood out to me because that's like a dish from the UK, or, and you know, it was it Fortnum and Mason like called it a scotch egg first, but then it was like a mogul dish. So it was like,
right.
I mean, it's just, it's so mushed up. And then now it's like this New York Mexican thing with chorizo.
Yeah, we're definitely fascinated by the idea of appropriating techniques from other cultures. And it's a slippery slope because people are really passionate about their favorite cuisine, whether that be, you know, Vietnamese or Thai or Mexican or what have you. So when you start to tinker with it, sometimes it can rub people the wrong way. But for us, we kind of look at Mexican cuisine at its core, which is that it is a fusion cuisine. It is a cuisine of appropriation and indigenous fusion. And who's to say that that has to stop? Like who draws the line of when a cuisine stops evolving and stops growing and now is just at a time where it should be documented and codified and studied and researched? And no one can really answer the question. Like at the end of the day, if someone thinks it's delicious and great,
mm-hmm.
if they want to talk about it and hear the thought process behind it, and if that pisses them off, that's great too. So
I get sad when there's kind of like, you know, sort of there is sort of no Indian restaurant in New York that I'm like, oh yeah, like, you know, that's what grandma makes, you know, or mom mm-hmm. makes. And I just remember having like a mole epiphany where I had like a $25 mole at like some restaurant in LA when I used to live there, and it was like gloppy stuff and it had no taste.
Mm-hmm.
And then I, you know, took some cooking class and learned how to make mole, and it was like, oh well, mole is actually just kind of like Thai curry when it's made right. You smush up all these spices and good stuff fresh, and then it becomes this amazing sauce.
Yeah, it's an amalgam of all these ingredients.
So I love that. Well, you know, doing ethnic food in a different way, I mean, it's like something that is doing well, you know, in New York, started by David Chang and then Andy Ricker, and then, you know, Danny Bowie is not even Chinese, and so everyone has their thing. Not business-wise, it must be the restaurant business. Must be like painful to, you know, when you first started, to be like, oh great, like everyone who walks in is gonna like want a margarita and want some guacamole for the table because the table is still deciding what to order, and like awesome, and that's gonna up the bill at the end of the day, and that makes it a viable business, but like sort of painful. So I mean, lessons learned from doing ethnic food in this way business-wise, and like, you know, for future restaurateurs, like what?
Well, you brought up margaritas and guacamole. I can tell you that my initial inclination is to try to begin to take things away.
Mm.
And I've actually kind of decided that that's a huge mistake. I had it in my head that once upon a time, Cocina was just going to, it was never going to serve a taco. And now we do. And I back to the point of margaritas and guacamole, those things might not be the biggest deal in Mexico, but we have to admit as Americans that they are something that we love. And I actually have to admit that's something I love. So rather than say like, well, if so long as we have this on the menu, we're sellouts or we're not doing our goal, I would much rather make those things incredibly well and think of them as a gateway or a portal to trying other things.
Mm-hmm.
So if I can get someone to sit down and have a margarita and guacamole, but by the end of their meal they're drinking mezcal neat, or they're tasting a mole or something else perhaps that they had never had before, I can't really see the bad in it. I think it would be the equivalent of trying to say, well, I have an Italian restaurant, I'm going to take away pasta. It's like, I appreciate that sort of punk rock mentality of like, well, whatever people want, go against it. But at the end of the day, like we are restaurants, and it's like me personally, I don't think I'm willing to give up guacamole and margaritas, just to be honest.
Punk rock mentality. So I don't want to be like, what's it like to be known as the chef who's like, well, fuck you, but
like, I am not that type of chef.
No,
just for the record,
no, not even a bad way, but in like a, you're blazing your own path. And I ask this like more like, it's really hard to be the one to be creative and to say, you know what, I'm gonna do Mexican food in this way that I love. And
it's tough. It's tough. Like our second restaurant was a huge challenge, and it still is a huge challenge. It's doing great.
Yep.
And I'm thankful for that. But like sometimes I have to wonder. Like sometimes I'll like, look, I'm serving weird Mexican food in kind of an off neighborhood. You know what I mean? And it's like you have to stick to your guns, and you have to believe that you're doing it for a reason,
mm-hmm.
which is like, I'm not even sure what that reason is other than that. I really like to challenge the kitchen, and I really like to challenge myself, and if we can have a restaurant that can hopefully change the rules as to what can exist on a Mexican menu, well, then great. Then it's serving its purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, I have a restaurant across town in the West Village that sells a taco every 7 seconds.
Whoa. That's fun.
Yeah, on average, we did the math. And it's kind of like...
Wait, did you guys tweet that? That's just such a cool tweet. Anyway, no, I actually really dig, you know, for... I know that you're a lover, not a hater. You know why that? I know that because on your menu, you have this specific quote that's like, Empeon strongly discourages the use of cell phones unless you're posting food porn on Instagram, hashtag Empeon. You're like, you know what, guys? Like, let's spread the love, you know?
Yeah, totally. Me personally, my nature is to be overly serious I sometimes force myself to poke fun at myself, just to avoid that at all costs.
Yeah, you just got a fake Twitter account too, right?
I know. I've arrived.
Really? Oh my gosh!
Someone.
I gotta look this up.
Yeah,
right
someone
now.
Out there took the Twitter account Chef Alex Stupak, and I'm gonna get this guy or girl, whoever's doing it, because it doesn't say it's a parody account, and the guy is actually answering people
on my behalf.
I have. I won't say on the air who I think it is, but I think I know who it is.
Wait,
I think
but why
I have a
would?
Good idea.
But hold on, this is like really sort of eerie. Why would someone want to do that to you? And also, it's.
I think they're just busting my balls. I
mean, this is hilarious! Making tacos on masa wire at a time.
Yeah, it's definitely a smart ass. Like I said, I have a good idea who I think it is, but I can't prove it.
Okay, Chef Alex Stupak. I love that you're sort of on social media, and that, you know, I do, at least I've talked to some chefs and sommeliers, and you know, it's, for some reason people talk about it like it's homework, but I've seen some really sort of amazing friendships and connections happen just via tweeting at each other, and it's sort of like, you know what, I call it the mise en place of meeting someone. Like, you sort of have it all set up on Twitter, and then when you run into them, you don't have to make that small talk anymore. You don't have to be like, well, how's the weather? You can be like, well, I loved what you just said the other day.
Sure, absolutely. Chris Cosentino, I actually met him through Twitter, and he ended up...
Oh my God.
Yeah, and he ended up doing... I was tweeting out, I said, hey, if anyone knows where to get papichia, let me know. And papichia is this sort of... it's an obscure herb used a lot in Oaxaca. And Chris bounced it right back. He's like, you know what? That stuff grows. It's all over the green market here in San Francisco, and I'm going to be in town in 2 days. I'll bring you some.
Cool.
So he came by the restaurant. He gave me some, and I sat him down, and I cooked him a meal, and then we had a beer, and then we talked about doing a dinner together, and then 3 months later, we did it.
That's amazing. One of the Push Project dinners.
Yep.
When's the next one?
The next one is on November... November 7th, I think. 7th. It's a Thursday. I won't release the name of the chef yet.
I'm totally going to be there.
But it's going to be a good one.
Yeah, it sounds amazing.
And this will be an interesting one, too, because this is the first time we'll actually be applying a strict theme to the menu, an actual challenge to the menu of what we're trying to prepare.
That's very TV of you. I want to talk about where you two are from, because that's such a big part of American food and how we experience food. I mean, so Steven?
I grew up in the Midwest. I unfortunately was an extremely picky child, like very picky. I am Mexican, so...
You are?
Yeah, so that's... Mexican food is very close to my heart, and I'm also like, I'm a little biased because, you know, I remember my grandmother cooking, and I know how much love goes into cooking Mexican food. Like, it's like, I mean, yeah, it's like technique and ingredients and stuff like that, but it's that like X factor ingredient.
Like Water for Chocolate-ish.
I never saw that movie, but yeah.
The book.
Probably, yeah. but my diet as a child pretty much consisted of chicken McNuggets from McDonald's and grilled cheeses.
Doesn't get much more Mexican than that.
Actually, kind of, sort of, in a very sad way.
So I didn't really get I didn't really start developing any sort of palate until I graduated high school and moved and was able. I don't know what kind of came over me, but I just wanted to try everything. Like my mom was, she was a good cook, but I think a lot of Midwest families, she cooked her steaks like well done, and you know, like didn't have a lot of like great technique, but also still a lot of love and
sauce makes up for her.
Yeah. So I don't know. Growing up, my food knowledge and my food exposure was pretty low. So I didn't really develop like any sort of desire to like try different things or anything until I was like 20 years old.
So you're a Mexican American. Correct. Do you know what part of Mexico?
Yes, my grandmother is actually from Morelia, Michoacan.
Awesome.
Yeah, my grandfather's from Mexico City.
So where is this? I can't say it.
It's a Morelia.
A Morelia.
It's like 3 hours outside of Mexico City, right?
Yeah.
It's a very, very beautiful, like kind of like colonial city. Great food. I mean, I haven't been in quite some time, but I'm pretty excited to eventually go back soon.
Mm-hmm. So. And how about you, Alex?
I'm from a small town in the middle of Massachusetts called Leominster. It is the birthplace of Johnny Appleseed. apparently he was born there, and then he got the hell out. They are known for their plastic production. It is the birthplace of the pink flamingo lawn ornament.
Wow, that's like such a thing for humanity.
Yeah, and that's about it. That's what it's known for. To anyone who does know that, which I think most people even in Leominster don't.
That's okay. My hometown, the world's largest auto square.
There you go.
That's how cool I am. Okay, go on.
But yeah, I grew up in like I'm a mix. My dad is half Russian and half French, and my mom's half Italian and half French. So I didn't grow up. They don't speak any of those languages, so I don't speak any of those languages. I didn't grow up with any sort of clear ethnic cuisine at all. So all of my food experiences were very much forced. I mean, I remember being a little kid and watching in Julia's Kitchen with Master Chefs, and I remember watching someone like Jean George make a souffle, or someone like Jean-Louis Paladin roast foie gras. And I always had it in my head at a really young age, for whatever reason, that I wanted to cook.
Hmm.
So I washed dishes when I was like 12 years old, and I worked at everything from a diner to a country club to a catering company to a you name it. And then I got out. I went to culinary school and moved to Chicago, and then moved back to Boston, and then moved back to Chicago, and then moved to New York. And so everything that I love to cook has been very self-exposed and sort of intentional.
Mm-hmm. Did your mom cook?
Nope. My mom didn't cook. My dad cooked a little bit at home. Mm-hmm. My dad did most of the cooking, and he's a really good cook.
Wow.
How do you think it differs as opposed to like when you have to seek out that knowledge and that inspiration as opposed to when some families just grow up with like, you know, amazing food and you have dinner
like Bryce
every
and
night.
Eamon, you know, who are on last week.
How do you think that affects?
I'm not sure. Like, I mean, again, I think it's really down to the individual and their experience. I don't think it's like, well, if you're brought up this way, you end up like X. And if you're brought up this way, you end up with Y. Like, I mean, some people might be, I could imagine someone being brought up with the best Thai food or the best Mexican food ever. And then even though those flavors are incredibly nostalgic as a chef, maybe they want to have nothing to do with them because they're too familiar. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like when my wife, Lauren, her mother is Mexican. And when I told her that I wanted to do a Mexican restaurant, she was like, really? Why? Like, cause she grew up with it and she didn't see it as something as precious or exotic or new, or she thought of it as something very common and very typical. So again, maybe that has something to do with it.
Like
if you're brought up with it, maybe it doesn't feel as special, but that's purely speculative.
Yeah. I feel like more connected to it, like growing up with it, you know, like a taco is like my comfort food, you know, like it's just something that I feel like if I'm sad, I like want to go have some tacos.
One of the cool things about ethnic cuisine, it's cool slash, it's not a problem, but it's something you run into a lot, is that people, whether they were brought up with it or whether they were born in California and they feel like they know where the greatest taco stand on earth is, people feel like they own it. And they definitely own their opinion of it. And they'll have it whatever you're making. If you're making a taco, they will hold that taco up against in what the perfect taco is in their brain. And for a while, I thought that was just, well, that's just an American phenomenon. But it's actually, even in Mexico, what I've noticed in the little bit that I've been there is that, again, I think it's very similar when people tell me, I've never been to Italy, but when people tell me about the regionality of Italy and how you could be, people will disregard the cuisine of the next town over or the next village over. I've experienced that very much so in Mexico, where to the point where kind of the unwritten or unspoken attitude is that, like, well, if you're in Puebla, it's as if it's not a disregard of Oaxaca. It's more as if it doesn't exist. Like Puebla is Mexico. And it's kind of interesting because you kind of learn that there really isn't any such thing as Mexican cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
There's Pueblan cuisine and there's Oaxacan cuisine. And within all these little regions, there's, you know, subsets and different opinions and no one can agree. So it's total anarchy. So if you're into that, it's pretty cool.
And then that just means that the Mexican food that is so New York flavored that you're making is truly like a new kind of Mexican. It's another animal, but it is Mexican food.
The challenge with Mexican food in New York is that some of the pieces of the puzzle are still missing. And we, like, my drink, like,
ingredients.
Ingredients. I mean, and look, it's like you could use only local ingredients, the best local chicken and vegetables or what have you. The thing that seems to be missing is that a lot of us are still not getting fresh masa. And we're still not making tortilla. I mean, hell, right now at Empeón, we make flour tortillas. They're traditional Mexican flour tortillas. But the reason we make those is because we can't process our own masa yet. And we as a restaurant, agreed that, well, whatever we're going to make it within the four walls. Otherwise, we're not going to serve it. But, like, honestly, like, my dream for my next thing wouldn't even be a restaurant per se. It would be a masa processing factory first and then see what we could build onto it.
That would be so cool. Yeah. Have you seen in, you know, the years that you've done your thing in this town, you seeing change? I mean, there's also like this weird, is this a moment for Mexican food?
I mean, it might be. I've heard some rumors of a very big Mexican chef that's going to plant here. I won't name names.
You're not gonna,
I'm not
written down in my notebook here, but
I don't know. I'm not sure if it's a secret or not. But yeah, I think that, again, it's like we can say that, well, there's a Mexican food explosion if we see 20 new exciting restaurants. But at the end of the day, like, try to equate it to an Italian restaurant that's opening up in New York City right now is not going to have a hard time sourcing the cheeses they need or the flours that they need to make pasta a certain way. They're not going to have a hard time sourcing that. If a Mexican chef from Mexico comes here, they're going to notice immediately that the garlic tastes different, the cilantro tastes different. Masa factories aren't on every block. You can't get squash blossoms in January. There's a lot of challenges to the cuisine. I think there's a way to push through that. So that's one of the things for the future I'm really excited about. It's like, well, if we can't get Mexican wine, well, then I should open a Mexican wine import business. If I can't get fresh tortillas all the time made for me, then I should open a tortilla factory. I feel like those are the pieces of that's what I mean, like, pieces of the puzzle are missing.
Mm-hmm.
But if we complain about that, well, then shame on us. It's like, well, what are we doing about it?
And I think it's also on us, I mean, to travel and do that kind of research where we're eating the food in that country. I mean, I saw that Will Goddard and Daniel Humley went to Mexico recently, Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be, I mean, if they're going there, it's to eat and to, you know, I'm excited.
Totally.
For
like
people like that going to Mexico. You wouldn't normally think, oh, you know, you want to go to Italy to eat, you know.
I do think the world is, I mean, it doesn't matter what I think, it's a fact. Like, the spotlight, the culinary spotlight is kind of shining really intensely right now on Mexico and actually all of Latin America.
Is this something to do with the changing demographics and just, you know, I mean, it's bigger picture, like,
I think it has to do with it takes time for people to realize things, but if the right group of people begin to realize it, then they can be very powerful in making sure that the rest of the world does.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Scandinavia a few years ago, then Spain before that. I think every region
has this like moment.
Yeah, and I mean, now I think people are just really starting to get introduced to Mexican food, and people like Alex Itala, and like in Brazil, like, you know, those ingredients that they use down there, even in Mexico as well, like people have never seen, you know, like, it's insane. Like, I think it was, I forgot who I spoke to who had who Alex Aitala's Food said that literally like almost 75% of what they ate they had never seen before. Like, that's cool, and that's something special, and that's like doing food like of a place, you know, very much how like, you know, like Sean Brock, you know, is doing the food from the South, and Hugh Atchison and all these different, you know, I think that's really cool to put a spotlight on that. And like right now, like Alex was saying, like when you get the right people to look at a certain area, and you know those people's opinions are really, really like focused on and respected, then you know the sky's the limit.
So you're listening to Word of Mouth with Les Tissus, yours truly. We're here with Alex Tupac and of Empeon Cocina and Taqueria and Steven Torres, founder of ImbibeAndInspire.com. And I would love to shift to, you know, bigger picture, which is what American food. We're going to talk American food when we're in Chicago now. What does American food mean to you two? You know?
Well, I think Steven should answer that because he's the one who's trying to get a conference done on the subject.
American food means to me is very regional. You know, I think like where Alex grew up, like I think like fried clams and lobster and like all these like seafood like oriented dishes, not necessarily composed plates, but dishes, you know. In the South, you know, you think of like pork and all these different things. And I think that I don't like using the word curate, but I tried to curate the the best individuals possible to kind of talk on all of these different subjects.
So let's talk about some of those individuals, like Kyle Connaughton.
Yeah, like Kyle, you know, he grew up in California and he went and worked in Japan for 5 years with Michelle Bra, and then became the head of R&D for the Fat Duck. And I don't want to give away the like what the talk topics are, but let's just say like what he's talking about is very focused on what he knows and where he came from in that sense. And Alex is talking about something really, really awesome as well that we kind of focused on together, which was great.
And then we have Hugh Atchison.
Hugh Atchison is obviously going to talk about the South and what's like, you know, what's going on there right now.
He's Canadian and he's married to a Southerner, and the South is like another country, you know, without like a line.
Right.
It makes me so happy that these fellows are, you know, doing the food that they love. And actually, it's part of that inspiration is sort of the, you know, when you fall in love with someone, then the food and the love and the love and the food. And it just makes me very
Well, I think also, happy. Too, I mean, I wanted to start this off very small because I wanted to focus on each chef and I wanted to make sure that they are taken care of. You know, I feel like sometimes in these other conferences that are happening in the United States, like, the chefs are there and, you know, like, I want them to feel like, you know, get picked up at the airport. Like, I'll carry their bags. Like, I'll, like, you know, just welcome them to Chicago.
Steven's going to carry your bags.
Nice. Sweet.
But, like, you know, I want them to feel at home. You know, one of the things that I did to, like, all, like, I sent an email to all these chefs. I said, you know, tell me your favorite alcohol of choice. What's your favorite snacks? What's your favorite? Because like I want to put a gift basket in their hotel to make them feel like they're, you know, I mean, because they're not getting anything out of this. Like they are doing me a favor, you know. And yeah, you know, like Alex, you know, can go to Chicago whenever he wants. So it's not like, you know, it's a trip, but I want them to really have a great time, and I want them to want to do it again, you know.
So you're really big on keeping it a secret until we get there, and I'm like now dying to know what we're going to talk about because I don't think it's going to be like your average bear of a, you know, panel or a bunch of talks. And are people going to be able to enjoy the content afterwards if they can't make it out to Chicago?
Yes, we're gonna have a videographer there recording it, so we'll definitely have that going. And you know, I mean, hopefully there'll be a lot of people like tweeting and talking about it. And you know, I think, you know, so, you know, during the day, so it's $250, includes the whole day. So during the day.
Sunday, September 29th.
Yes, at the Wyndham Grand Hotel in Chicago, Illinois. So it's $250, 8 talks during the day, ranging from all sorts of different things, all based on America and, like, the food ways, as we said. But then, you know, then we're doing this amazing dinner where, you know, it's wine pairing, well, beverage, alcoholic pairings, nine courses with different chefs, you know, from all over the country, well, and all over the world, because Rocio Sanchez from Noma is going to be hooking, which is awesome. She's a Chicago girl.
She used to be my sous chef.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes. She's my Sith apprentice. I'm very proud of her.
Wow. Ridiculously small world in the restaurant biz. I mean, you guys first met at Alinea, you two, right?
Well, we both worked there, and then we met after.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess this is now a very selfish question, because I always kind of end up doing all this like research in a hurry before I go to a place, and I haven't been back to Chicago in a long time. So what are we going to be eating there? Like, what, I mean, you know, I know you're there earlier, and I'm going to be there. Like, what is good to eat in Chicago? What's top of mind in Chicago?
Like as far as chefs go, or like what restaurants or
things to eat?
I think what Matt Meredith is doing at Yusho is like street yakitori Japanese food is awesome. I mean, Chicago has great Mexican food.
Hmm. You wouldn't have thunk.
Wow, yeah. Wow. Like, but yeah, it's just really, really good Mexican food. What's that Samitas place?
I'm not sure which one you mean.
Is it Puebla Samitas?
I haven't been.
Oh. I can't remember the name, but that's insane for just like simple like Samitha, like straight up. Like, I think it's like $4. It's like the best $4 you'll spend.
Mm.
What else? I mean, I love what Dave Barron is doing at Next. Mm-hmm. You know, Alex just went to Boca.
Yeah, I just had an incredible meal there. That was my second time there. Those guys, I'm always kind of blown away with what they pull off. Just operationally, we always think, oh, a restaurant's so hard, blah, blah, blah. But, like, I mean, to completely flip not only a menu, but a concept 4 times a year, it's pretty insane. It's like watching someone walk a tightrope.
What did you have any other good meals?
I didn't get to eat that much. I went to Next and then went to Aviary, and the next day I had a really, really great dinner at Topola Bombo. And then other than that, we did a dinner so late night we went to Au Cheval, which I had never been to. Had a really awesome burger and fries and some chopped chicken liver, but that was this trip.
Yeah.
Well, looking forward to seeing you guys in Chicago now. How do people find out about this? Buy tickets?
If you can just you can go on my Twitter page, which is at @imbibe_inspire,
mm-hmm.
and the link, you know, like the little link underneath where like it should be the website is actually the Eventbrite page.
So I want to ask you one last question, Alex. Is mm-hmm. what advice for cooks, younger chefs, young chefs, people just starting out? You know, you've kind of like forged a pretty cool path, and you know, just advice for people coming after you.
Advice. I don't like the only advice. I mean, this will sound trite, but I mean, it's really just to put your head down and work. Mm-hmm. I mean, my attitude is this, is that like, well, it's okay to change your mind, because I change it often. I had no idea or no intention I was ever going to be a pastry chef. And going into it, I had no idea that I would ever fall in love and focus on Mexican cuisine. So I think changing your mind along the way is fine. I think no matter what happens to you, it's fine. I think what the constants have to be that you have to do it with the intention in mind, the core intention that you're out to make people happy. And that's kind of it. And you have to work your ass off. I think if you do those two things, everything else might change along the way in terms of what you're cooking or who you're cooking with or what country you're in or all of that. But if you have those two core intentions, I don't know how you can fail.
Thanks so much. Talk to us online. It's #WOMshow, WOM show, and @imbibe_inspire to find out details about this or Roots of American Foodways in Chicago at the end of this month. And then at Alex Stupak, at Leti Sue, at heritage_radio.com. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leti Sue. And we're going to wind down.
We're winding down.
You know, I've actually asked some guests before to bring a bottle of wine and have been shot down, sadly, because apparently even among food people, 10 a.m. is too early to have a drink. But so what I'm excited
about this one article that my buddy Jonathan Cristalli, formerly in New York and now in California, he wrote on First We Feast. And we all know that wine ratings are obsolete, sort of, right? I mean, that's like, they are, you know? And there used to be a wine rating system that was a 20-point system, I think, a guy at UC Davis. And then, you know, Parker came up with the 100-point thing, which was kind of like the most brilliant marketing, you know, construct ever, because 100 points is more understandable to, you know, folks in the UK and in America, where we go to school and we're judged on, you know, A-, B plus, C. So, the, you know, wine being such a subjective thing, sort of an art, if you will, to say something is an A- is really irrelevant. And of course, the 100-point scale was necessary for Americans early on in our wine drinking days to begin to wrap our arms around something that was, you know, a European, very European new thing. I think we've moved past that. So I'm going to give you one thought, which is that go find the wine that you love yourself, and that's via, as Johnny says, your friends and determination. Friends in that now we've got social media, we've got friends who love wine. Go ask your friends what they like, you know. Have a conversation about it. Have an amazing time having dinner and drink a wine, and then ask your friends about it and talk about it. Determination. For me, learning about wine is I think about it, it's like a bookcase theory of learning about wine. Just take a step back and think, is it a region or is it a grape? I'm not even going to use the fancy word varietal or variety or whatever is the right word that I, you know, we often misused. And have your bookshelf and know where to put the books. And then taste consciously. Of course, drink and enjoy. But then once you know that this is a Riesling from Australia, or that it's a Cab Franc from Northern New York, or that it's a Pinot Noir from Oregon, suddenly you can begin to build your taste memory and get to know wine a little bit better. Thanks so much for listening. Next week, we're going to have Patrick Capiello, wine director at Pearl & Ash, on. So see you next week. Be good and yummy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Letting you go.